Agency, and you're tuned to WBFY LP, Belfast, Maine, at 100.9 FM.
Support for Belfast Community Radio comes from our listeners and from the Old Professor's Bookshop, a Harvard Square bookstore in downtown Maine, featuring a unique selection of scholarly and rare new and used books, located at 99 Main Street, open 10 to 4 most days.
Hello, hello, it's Ellen Sander, host of Poetry Woodshed Radio. Not your ordinary poetry hour full of readings, recordings, spoken word, commentary, quirk, and quintessential poetry love. For the connoisseur and the merely curious, we have the classics, the contemporaries, the beats, the geeks, the jammers, and the slammers. So join us right here on WBFY.
Poetry Woodshed's hours are Wednesday at 7 p.m. and Saturday at 11 a.m.
Welcome to Books and Writers, the show for writers, aspiring writers, and anyone fascinated with creative writing. I'm your host, Spencer Stevens. On Books and Writers, we'll talk with those who know writing as both an art and as a science, who know how to make writing work, how to get it noticed, how to find inspiration, and how to avoid ruts and get out of them. We'll discuss habits, habitats, and brains of writers, editors, publicists, book bloggers, bookstore owners, publishers, and others. We'll talk about the books that should have succeeded but didn't. We'll talk about the writers who broke the rules and succeeded anyway. We'll look at books in progress. We'll lead you to becoming a better writer, or at least to a deeper appreciation of your favorite writers. Our guest this week on Books and Writers is writer Jim Crochelle, a Mid-Coast Maine writer, memoirist, and poet. Jim has written four books, the most recent of which is 2018's One Man's Maine, Essays on a Love Affair. The book won the John N. Cole Award for Maine-themed nonfiction from the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance and a bronze medal from Forward Reviews. He's also written East of Edgerton, a memoir about his Peace Corps work in Korea, Owl's Head Revisited, an homage to Owl's Head, and Saving Maine, about the history of Maine's rocky environment and its settlement by humans. His Maine-themed work often focuses on Maine's natural beauty and protection of its resources. Jim started life as a Midwesterner, growing up in Minnesota. He had a career in publishing, working for Little Brown & Company and for Blackwell and Elsevier, handling editing, acquisitions, and sales, often involving books about science. He's published dozens of pieces in literary and environmental journals. He has a bachelor's degree in English from Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and a master's degree in English from Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. Jim Crochelle, welcome to Books and Writers. We're happy to have you here and eager to chat with you about your experiences and your lessons learned. Let's start with what might have been your second book, I guess it was, One Man's Maine, Essays on a Love Affair.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about that and what you had hoped to accomplish by writing it.
Yeah, well, once I got to be retired and live much more, spend more time in Maine, I got to writing essays. And these were what some people call familiar essays, where you take something that's pretty familiar in your life, especially having to do with the natural world, say a moose or a lichen or a bird. And then you describe some of the science behind that, but you'd also try to relate it to your life or the bigger world. So I started writing those pretty heavily, and at some point I started to publish those pretty widely in various little magazines and journals, and it came to me that why not collect them in a book? That was the genesis of the book.
When you were writing these essays, did you have in mind that they would be published or shared with the public, or maybe like some writers do, you had in mind that you were just writing for yourself or maybe for friends or family?
No, it was for publication. I did want to get my message out. We'll talk about that later, I assume. But I didn't want to get the message out about how much Maine meant to me and how much conservation and environmental behavior meant to me. I wanted to get those messages out, so I started to publish those in various little magazines and journals.
Okay. And let's focus on the Maine aspect for a minute. When did Maine become part of your life, and how did it become part of your life?
Well, when I was, I'm from the Midwest, so I grew up in many different places in the Midwest, including a stint in Canada. But when I was 12, my family came out to visit Maine. My uncle, who lived in Brunswick, we visited him for a week or two. And that was, what shall I say, we went to Popham Beach. Do I need to say anything more?
I'm not familiar with Popham Beach, and some of the listeners might not be. So tell us just a little.
Yeah, it's one of the, it's probably the most beautiful beach that I've seen in my life. It's between two rivers, the Kennebec and the Swift. I can't remember the other name. Down by Brunswick, and it's a beautiful beach. There's islands offshore, and the tide is amazing, and there's sand flats. It's an amazing place. So once a 12-year-old boy sees that, that's pretty impressive. But also my uncle was a professor at Bowdoin. So between walking the quad at Bowdoin and walking the sand flats at Popham, it was pretty impressive. And that remained with me for the rest of my life. And that was kind of the first time I came to Maine. And that was the impetus.
Excellent. And how long was it before you began writing about Maine?
I would say it took until I retired in 2008. I've been sort of dabbling in fiction for most of my life. But once I got here and got to experience how wonderful it is, it was compelling to me to try to get that down, that natural world down on paper. So that's when I really started to write about Maine, in 2008-ish.
Okay. And as I went through One Man's Maine, which I have been through most of it, I saw an awful lot of writing that focused on environmental and scientific concerns. Tell me about the inspiration for that. Where did that come from?
Well, I was an English major, yes, but I also started off my college career as a pre-med student. So I went through all pre-med, did a lot of science, and I guess science has stuck with me for that experience. And then coming to Maine, I think the obvious thing that stares you in the face every day is the incredible environment. What a beautiful place this is, and how fragile it is, and it's being developed, and so. Once I retired, I also started to volunteer for a local land trust to try to preserve some of this beauty. So those things together, the love of science, the love of the land and the need to preserve it and to serve it, came together in my writing and my essays.
Okay. And the essays I see, they're not written by someone who is an avid hunter or fisherman. They're not written by someone who is trying to develop the land. They're written by someone who's trying to preserve it. And tell me where that comes from. What was your inspiration there?
I guess what you call a backyard naturalist. I'm not a outdoors person in the traditional sense. But I think I see, having lived in various places in the world and traveled a lot, and I just see development taking over so quickly, and not just development, but all the same kind of development, fancy houses and malls and big buildings, and it seems to be taking over the world. And I really would prefer to be in quiet places and beautiful places and not have the noise and clamor of the modern world always around. I mean, there's a place for it, and development is certainly good in certain places, but I think we should try to preserve the natural world as much as we can.
So your attraction to Maine, like for so many of us, is the peace and the quiet and the beauty, and that sounds like it was a big part of your inspiration for the subjects of your essays in One Man's Maine.
That is correct. Yes, and not just the animals too, of course, and the plants. So all of the natural world, and as you probably noticed in reading through them, how this relates to the human world is of crucial importance. So that I also tried to get at.
Yes, In one of your essays, and the title of this particular one may come to mind in a minute. Oh, it was Rockweed, I think. You talked about the role of rockweed, seaweed in Maine, and I learned from reading there that it's being harvested at a rate that probably is unsustainable. And I'm wondering how that came to your attention, how you learned about that, and how that got to be important to you.
I think it's just one of the many things. Maine, over its history, has been a incredible source of natural resources, and therefore exploited. Trees and blueberries and all kinds of things have grown here, have been exploited, fishing, of course. And this is another one that seemingly kind of innocuous thing, almost ordinary. Here's a really ordinary thing also being exploited and possibly being eradicated. So I see those even in the most ordinary things in life, that we have, as humans, we have a tendency to kind of fish things out until they're gone. So, but also Maine is a good place to see how that can be controlled, especially in the lobster industry. It's really a fantastic job by the state and its regulators to keep that a vibrant industry. So maybe there's hope for rockweed too.
Let's hope, yes. I was struck by the rockweed essay, partly because the subject was one I had given little thought to, and I found it fascinating the way you wrote about it. And I also found it fascinating the role that seaweed plays in the cycle, the ecological cycle that keeps our oceans full of living organisms, living animals. And it led me to believe you must have done some study or some research there. I'm wondering if that's true.
Yes, I'm not a scientist, sort of a research scientist. What I call research is reading stuff online as much as I can, but I don't go to great scientific depths. I try to glean the facts that a normal person, a regular person, might be interested in, and then put those together for in an interesting way. So yes, there's research, but it's kind of, it's not scientific research, heavy duty.
Sure. Is this internet research or something more intense than that?
No, it's usually just what I can find on the internet. And again, I'm trying to interpret these things for a more general audience, not for a specialized one.
Sure, sure. Well, it's inspiring and encouraging that something so well done and something so enlightening as your rockweed essay could be based upon something that's so universally available to most of us as the internet research. That's pretty neat. I like that.
Yeah, and the good news about rockweed in particular, I wrote that essay about 4, 5, 6 years ago already, and the whole aquaculture business has really increased, but it seems to be going on a sustainable rate. There's a lot of interest in keeping it sustainable and let's not fish it out. Mm-hmm. So good news.
So conditions regarding practices and conditions related to the harvesting of rockweed, have they improved since you wrote your essay?
Yes, there's more regulation for one thing, and people are understanding that you just can't take everything. So there's that whole, I think that's a big lesson of what's happened in this century, is that sustainability is really not only achievable, but profitable.
Yes, excellent. And I was also struck by your essay titled Felling Trees. That part of life in Maine is one that I feel like I've seen a fair amount of. And I feel like Mainers have a love relationship with trees. And it sounds like you must have seen the same thing or felt it at least.
Oh, absolutely. I love trees. They're the most amazing thing. There's lore and tales and symbols about trees throughout the world in all cultures. A lot of people believe that they connect heaven and earth, for example. So it's an amazing, they're amazing things. And the science that's coming out about how trees communicate these days. It's just, it's kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah.
They actually kind of talk to each other through their roots and through the air, through scent, and what we would call pheromones. Fantastic.
Yes. There was a book that came out about 2 or 3 years ago, and it won the Pulitzer Prize, called Overstory, by a fellow whose name I think is Richard Powers. Did you happen to pick that up?
No, I happened to pick it up. It's one of my favorite books of the past year or two. A fantastic book.
It really is. I agree. I thought about that particular book as I was reading the Felling Trees essay that you wrote, and I wondered if there might be a connection. It sounds like there might have been.
Well, he published his book after I wrote the essay, but I was certainly so taken with that book because for that very reason. He had so many interesting stories and such compassion and such love that came through so clearly.
Yes, okay. In your Felling Trees essay, you talk about your own effort at chopping up a tree that had fallen, and at the end of the day, you spoke of a primitive satisfaction of having worked as a body, not as a brain. And I really admired that little piece of prose and was wondering if there's anything in particular that that inspired it.
Well, you know, I've been in my brain too much for my whole life. You know, I've earned my bread by my brain. So it's nice to have the time to devote to things, to manual labor and to physical labor, and to realize that, you know, we're still, at the heart of it, we're still animals. We have bodies, and we're ruled in many ways by not only our needs, but by our emotions. And that all comes together when you do some really interesting, hard physical work, it seems, especially when it has a nice result of producing firewood.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the end of your Felling Trees essay, there was a bit of prose that I admired a bunch. It really stood out. It says, it's a childish kind of rebellion. I know that I won't chop it down, but I have come to believe that in the absence of doctrine and fathers, trees connect the earth to the sky, and only the tree cutter's simple physical grace saves him from sacrilege. Tell me what sacrilege are you referring to there? I admired the prose, but was a little mystified by the very end of that sentence.
Yeah, no, yeah. This is betraying some of my beliefs, of course, that we should be careful about how we use nature. That if you cut things down indiscriminately, that's a kind of sacrilege. You're going against the will of, let's say, a god or a religion. But if you do it wisely and sustainably, then it actually becomes your belief system. I think that's what I was trying to get at.
I gotcha. Sure, sure. And at the beginning of your book, I think it might have been your first essay, Berries, you talk about what looks like your introduction to Maine, or the something related to that. It talks about what I think were your daughters when they were not quite teenagers and the excitement they had with Maine. Am I reading that correct? Was that part of your introduction to Maine, or was that written after you had after you and Maine had become good friends?
Much after we had become good friends. That's a good way to put it, by the way.
Yeah.
My girls, two girls, grew up in vacations and holidays and weekends and stuff. So they've been coming to Maine their whole lives.
Wonderful. Your essay, Berries, talks about collecting raspberries with your family and putting them into a pie that you would sit down together and eat. And towards the end, you say, "I hope for my daughters that raspberries are the symbol of spontaneity. Do not buy them in supermarkets. Do not order them from dessert menus in January, naked in winter air and cold. Let them stay tender and fragile and fleeting. Left out in the old green boxes, they grow mold after a day or two. Stashed in the refrigerator, they lose all their taste. Let them grow and ripen without the heavy hand of moderation. Eat the whole pie at once." First, I admired that. It was a beautifully expressed thought. And it sounds like you're describing something of a marriage between admiring nature, wanting to preserve it, and wanting to take benefits from it all at the same time. Am I seeing that correctly?
Well, you're absolutely right. And that's, I think, what Maine offers so beautifully, is that it's kind of a beautiful marriage between mind and matter. It offers this contentment, and I think that maybe the berry symbolizes that. It's, you seize the moment, then you make something of it, and you have a wonderful memory. I mean, what more is life than that?
Yeah, sure. As I read through One Man's Maine, I began to wonder about your influences, what other writers you admired and who may have influenced you in your subject and even in your prose.
Well, the obvious one is E.B. White. In fact, I sort of ripped off the title of the book from his own essay collection called One Man's Meat.
Good for you.
Yeah, some people call it a rip-off. I call it a homage, because he was the, in fact, can I read what I wrote as a little introduction?
Absolutely.
To him from the book? The dedication is, in homage to E.B. White, whose delight in the ordinary, compassion in the face of chaos, and comfort in his own skin can only be imitated, never equaled. So he is my big influence. His essays about Maine and life are unparalleled. They're just amazing things that still get me a kind of shiver pumpy when I read them. After I read that book, One Man's Meat, at least every other year.
Sure.
So that's the big influence.
Sure. Outside of maybe Charlotte's Web, I don't think I've read anything by E.B. White. You've got me scribbling E.B. White on my list of folks I've got to read in the near future. I'm very intrigued. I thought I saw some possible influence from Garrison Keillor. Am I off base there?
That's an interesting one. I had never thought of that, but I did live in Minnesota for a while. That's where, yeah, he lives and works.
Yeah.
He likes the kind of down-home, homespun aspect of life, which I do too. I hope he's got a sense of humor. I know he does. I know he has a sense of humor, and I hope I do too. So I think there's some really good, that's a good catch.
Yeah. I've long been a fan, and even though he experienced some damage to his reputation because of the activities he was accused of, I have to confess, I still read his stuff and I still enjoy it. And his ideas are as good as ever.
Yes, and you may know that he produces a daily feed called the Writer's Almanac.
I'm a big fan. Yes.
Yes, and that's, he always has a poem. Then he has a group of birthdays or other notable literary events that he talks about. So, well worth keeping up on.
Sure. Now, I noticed with each of the essays in One Man's Maine, almost all of them had been published in literary journals or in journals of one type or another. And I'm curious about that process. Did you have it in mind that you were going to publish them individually and then collectively, or did it just kind of happen that way?
I think it happened, more just happened. I certainly wanted to publish them individually. That was the whole point of getting them out there, getting that message out there. But then I realized that, okay, if some of these are, many of these are about Maine, and they kind of group together, you know, in an interesting way. So why not actually make that happen and put a collection together and try to get it published?
Sure. As I was looking through the list in the back of One Man's Maine about the places where you'd published your essays, it occurred to me that you must have invested a substantial amount of effort in submitting and enduring some form of rejection here and there. And in the lessons learned category, I'm really curious what you've learned about getting pieces published in literary journals. That's a field that many of us, present company included, would like to know more about.
It is very difficult. There are hundreds and thousands of us trying to do this. Most literary journals get hundreds and thousands of submissions every year, if not more. So there's a huge competitive aspect to this. And you also have to get used to rejection, because all these journals are very often very idiosyncratic, and they have very specific needs and wants, and sometimes you don't see them when you read the journal online or wherever. So you have to get used to the fact that it's not personal necessarily. Your essay might be good, might not be good, but it's the rejection may be for who knows what reason.
Mm-hmm.
So I have calculated my acceptance rate, and maybe you'll be astonished to hear that it's 5%.
Holy geez.
Yeah, so basically I send out 20 attempts to get one acceptance.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound
competitive.
That doesn't sound unusual from my perspective. So,
right.
Did you learn anything about how to set yourself apart or how to improve your chances of getting accepted into a literary journal?
No, I have not. No. I suppose there might be a way if you really looked at a few journals carefully and tried to figure out what they want, but I could never do so. It seemed that most journals had a pretty wide range of stuff they wanted, and it didn't really behoove me. That kind of research didn't really pay off, mm-hmm. It seemed to me. I couldn't figure it out.
Sure. So it sounds like in your case, you wrote essays that you thought that you liked. They were essays that you were happy with, and you were fortunate enough to find places where they happened to agree. They were willing to publish them.
That's well stated. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's exactly the case.
Okay. I was afraid that it was going to be that simple and that complicated all at the same time.
It's kind of a numbers game, you know. You've got to send out a lot to get a few.
Yeah. Darn right. Do you subscribe to any literary journals? Did you have any familiarity with literary journals that might have helped before you did your submissions?
I don't think so, no. I look at a lot of journals online because most of them are free, as you may know.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at a lot. I don't subscribe to many. The New Yorker's about as far as I go. So I didn't really feel that helped that much. As I said, I couldn't really figure out what most journals' total editorial stance was.
I gotcha, sure. I admired, I'm backing up a little bit here, back to One Man's Maine again. I was struck by how many different facets of the natural environment that you addressed with your book. There's essays on everything from blueberries to painted firs to yellow finches to tea bags. And it sounds like a lot of your inspiration came just from everyday observations that you made while enjoying Maine. Am I right on that, or is it more complicated?
Oh, no, it's very simple. In fact, it's often difficult to winnow out the things I want to write about.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you get down to what the natural world is really like, it's amazing on almost every level and at almost on every species level.
Mm-hmm.
There's this incredible variety and wonder in almost every thing you look at. So it's a matter of curtailing my interests rather than expanding them.
Sure. The range of essays in One Man's Maine was, as I said, quite broad and varied. It left me wondering if there were any subjects that you maybe tried to address with an essay, maybe worked on, and then gave up. Were there any essays that you tried and didn't feel like you could do justice to your subject?
There were a couple that I have given up on, but I'm persistent, so only a couple of the 60 or 70 that I've written have not been published, let's say.
Okay.
And I've written a few more that I'm still hopeful for publication, that are still out there circulating.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And before you sent your essays off to literary journals, did you have other writers, other people, beta readers, review them and comment on them? I'm curious about the process of getting feedback before you dared to make submissions.
The word dare is a good one. This is not easy to submit stuff, as you probably know.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
kind of like, you know, it's putting your soul out there for public view. The writers have a variety of solutions and ways of doing this. Mine is to have only one reader, an editor, and that is my wife.
That do you know how many writers I've heard say that their spouse is the one?
Yeah, that thing is pretty common.
Yeah.
And fortunately, she's a professional editor, or was in her working life, so mm-hmm. she's really good.
That's very fortunate. I happened to attend a reading by Ann Beatty, who I think has a summer place in Maine near Blue Hill, and I asked her that question, the same question. I was very curious how someone as accomplished as her, how they dealt with the question of getting feedback. And she said, yeah, my husband is the one. I was flabbergasted.
Yeah. Now, you know, a lot of other writers participate in workshops. They have a whole group of people that can review and critique, but not for me. It's just not the way I'm set up.
Sure, just the one person. And is that a strict rule, or do you ever go beyond just your wife?
No, it's pretty strict. She's the only one who sees it before publication.
Okay. And do you take all of her suggestions, or dare I ask, are there some that you listen to and say, no, I'm not going to do that?
Well, she's got the door. She's in the other room with the door closed, so maybe I can be honest.
Okay.
I take almost all of them, quite frankly. She's really good. And so there's only a few things that I say, okay, well, there's some areas of disagreement here, and I'll choose me for once. But almost 90% of the stuff she says is perfect.
Yeah, well, I'd say that's a pretty high percentage. That's a pretty...
yeah.
You married well, Jim, it sounds like.
Yes.
Let's see here. Let's talk briefly about Owl's Head Revisited. That's a book you published in 2015, and I will confess that I've not been through that one. Is that also essays, or is that a different approach to things?
It's essays with a slightly different approach. So you may know Owl's Head is a little town just south of Rockland, and it's kind of an undeveloped, kind of a somewhat unknown place for being on the mid-coast. So we had a house there for 22 years, 23 years, and would spend vacations and holidays, etc. there. And so after I retired, I had this little idea, this little project that I would walk every single road in the town. And some driveways too, if there were dogs. So I did that, and then I wrote about it. And throughout, of course, you get into the history of the place, you get into the people of the place and the customs. And that was kind of my homage to that little beautiful town of Owl's Head.
Mm-hmm. And where did this idea come from, doing an essay on each of the roads? That's fascinating as an idea.
I don't know where it came from. I guess the original stimulus is, of course, the fantastic, great essay by Henry David Thoreau called Walking. So I'm a big walker. So I guess it was natural to try to cover the town mm-hmm. by walking.
Sure. Okay. I read somewhere, and I wish I could recall who said this, but I was reading a writer who was talking about their inspiration, and one thing they said was that you should pay attention to what you pay attention to, and it sounds like that philosophy has found its way into your thinking when it comes to your writing. Am I reading that part correctly?
Yes, and that's why walking is so great, because there's time to pay attention to stuff. You're not whizzing by. That's why also being a backyard naturalist is great, because you can sit and watch the birds and the squirrels and the chipmunks and really, really, really watch and pay attention.
Mm-hmm. Were you also a backyard naturalist, or when you've been living outside of Maine, have you also been a backyard naturalist? Let me ask it that way.
Not so much, no. I spend half my time, I'm still a Massachusetts resident,
okay,
officially, I always say that Massachusetts has my body, but Maine has my heart, or mind. But I'm still there. And I set out, you know, walking in there too and enjoy nature. But nature is so, so amazing here in Maine that it compels you to pay attention. Not so much in the city, at least for a person like me.
Sure, sure. I would, your perspective on walking is one that I find not only admirable, but that I identify with. I do a lot of walking myself, and it's always a pleasure to see things and to wonder about the stories behind them. It sounds like your thoughts when you go walking and when you see things are about the natural forces that are behind the phenomenon that you happen to observe.
That is partly true. In my book, All Said Revisited, it was more about the people and the culture and the history that I was looking for and thinking about. It somewhat different stance for me, but I thought it was very rewarding to think about this little town and its place in history.
Sure. Again, since I haven't read Owl's Head Revisited, I have to operate from a lack of knowledge. But were your observations there focused on nature as well, or did you go so far as to talk about people that you might have observed?
That was the focus, the people and the culture and history and what was going on at the moment and what I saw and what I could infer and what people I talked to. And that was the focus. Nature was certainly present, of course, because it's a beautiful place, and the ocean is all around that peninsula. And, so that was the starting point, but the end point was really, here's how it's said, is a cultural, historical thing.
Mm-hmm. Since you've published One Man's Maine and Owl's Head Revisited, I'm curious about the reception you've gotten and what you've learned about it. Has it taught you anything about your strengths as a writer and where areas where you might want to improve or add emphasis?
Yeah, good question. I think as a writer, you never stop evolving. You keep thinking and changing and wondering. I think I'm now writing poetry. Maybe it's a function of my age, but I'm finding that the emotional side of life, I've sort of neglected it. Not neglected it, but not dealt with it thoroughly and truly. So I've dealt with the emotional side of being in nature, which is an amazing feeling of awe and comfort and being home. But now there's this whole business of the emotional side of what's in a human being and how that goes out rather than how it is taken in. So that's kind of what I'm exploring with poetry now.
Okay. When you and I spoke before the interview, you had talked about the topic of searching for writing that suits you best. And it sounds like that's a process that you have given some attention to, and it's led you to the poetry that you're working on these days. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that's right.
Can you give us a little bit of a description about that process? How did you search, and what places did you find information or clues about what would suit you best?
Boy, I don't know. I haven't really thought about that. What drove me to thinking about poetry? I know what drove me to writing essays. That was the coming to Maine and spending more time here and getting the chance to really appreciate this wonderful place. So that was clear. I'm not quite sure yet. This is very recent, this poetry stuff. So I'm not quite sure yet what's going on.
Okay.
Well, maybe we should talk again in a year or two, and maybe I'll have a better answer.
That would be good. That would be good. It sounds like the poetry avenue was something that might have been an unspoken sort of a motivation, something that just left you inspired for reasons you couldn't fully explain.
Well, that's right. I was an English major in college and grad school, and read all the best works, including great poetry. And so I've always thought that poetry is the highest form of literary expression. I never felt I was good enough or dared to write it. maybe until now. Mm-hmm. Maybe it takes a bit of age and wisdom and experience to be able to do it.
I've always thought so. I've tried writing poetry without success and have always admired folks who did a good job at it, and have wondered a lot about the process of writing and rewriting and editing poetry, if it bears any similarities to the work you do in the prose field. Can you shed any light on that?
Well, it's much more intense. I can tell you that. Boy, you're worried about one word, two words here and there instead of sentences and paragraphs. So every word counts, and you really have to dig deep into yourself when you're writing poetry, seems to me, at least my experience so far. It's kind of painful, and it's you spend the time in a different way. You're not researching. You're not thinking about how the story goes, particularly. You're thinking about how the emotion goes in your whatever you're thinking about. So that's a whole different ballgame, and I'm finding.
Sure. What you're saying matches up with what I expected would be the case, that long periods of time might be spent haggling over commas or line breaks in words and what have you. It sounds like a lot of your attention is devoted to analyzing small things.
Yeah, it's a really a matter of getting at what you feel. And if that comes out in line breaks and certain words and punctuation and all that, that's part of it. Mm-hmm. But it really is trying to figure out which words and what combination of words, what music in a way, describes what you're feeling.
Sure. I'm curious, when you look at the number of days, weeks, or months that pass by between the time that you conceive of an idea for a poem and the time that you get to where you're happy with what you've got, is that comparable or different from the amount of time that it would elapse between the conception of an essay and the time when you got it completed and you were happy with it?
I think for a poem it's a little shorter, but not that much. Mm-hmm. It goes slowly, let's put it that way. In
sure.
Both cases, they go kind of slow.
Mm-hmm.
You can't rush this process. You have to put it down every once in a while and say, I'm not looking at this for a day or two, and mm-hmm. let it steep.
Yes. Do you have a connection with any community of other poets? Is that part of your world right now?
I'm thinking about it, but as we talked about before, it's really kind of frightening to throw yourself out in the world, especially if you're just starting out. So I haven't done it yet. I have a couple of readers. In contrast to what I did with my wife and essays, I now have a couple of readers of my poetry who are not my wife. So is that progress? I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's a way for getting into the poetic community. In fact, I know in Belfast there's a great community of poets here, and since I'm relatively new to this area, maybe that's something for me to look into.
Yeah, I would think so. I have come into contact with a number of folks around town. I live in Belfast, and there are a lot of poets around. It seems to be a popular occupation around here for some reason.
Yeah.
It's nice. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So the poems that you're working on now, do you hope to publish those, or are those more just for the personal joy of the writing?
The latter right now, but I imagine the publication bug won't get me at some point, and I want to get them out there. But right now, it's just mostly for me.
Okay. And I think you had said, you told us that you had started out writing fiction at some point. Am I remembering correctly?
Yeah, that was my obsession. I love fiction. I still write. I read almost entirely fiction. Mm-hmm. I don't read much else. So it was for years and years of weekends and holidays and vacations, I wrote novels.
Excellent.
And didn't do anything with them.
Okay. I was going to ask if you'd published any, but it sounds like no.
No, they weren't good enough.
No. Did your wife review the novels that you've written? Was she involved in that process?
Yeah, and she agreed.
Oh. honey, I admire how much work you put into it, but it's just not good enough.
Kind of was the message.
Yeah, that's so funny. When we talked a little while ago, before our interview began, you had described yourself as a tourist in residence in Maine, and I wonder, is that still how you see yourself? Is that your image of yourself?
Yes, that phrase is from Franklin Burroughs, who's a great writer down from Brunswick Way, Bowdoin professor. He coined that phrase, and I think it's just perfect that it's for people like me who are from elsewhere, from away, but love this place so much that we hope to be from Maine, mm-hmm. but we know we can never be from Maine. It's just there's something about living in this place for your whole life and more for generations that conveys something, means something that we probably will never understand.
Sure, sure.
So, yes, I'm still a tourist in residence.
Okay. And are you still doing essays? Is that still part of your routine?
No, I've stopped for a while. I still, as I mentioned, I still have a few out there seeking publication, but I've really devoted myself to poetry now.
Okay. And but you're still active daily writing, it sounds like. That's still part
yes.
of your daily activities.
Yes, it probably will be for a long, long time.
Well, happy to hear that. I've talked to an awful lot of writers, poets and prose writers both, who say the same thing, that they appreciate that their interest is one that they can pursue for the whole rest of their life if they want to.
Yeah, if you're a writer, you're never bored.
Yeah, very true. Very true. Now, before you became a writer, I think it was before, you had been a member of the Peace Corps and gone to Korea. I'm curious if that experience has inspired you at all, if you have or may will put together anything that might have been inspired by that experience.
Yes, it was a big experience. Peace Corps is an amazing thing. Your days are full of trauma and joy. You love it and you hate it. You can do that job and you can do anything. These are all the phrases that I came up with. You can do that job, you can do anything in the world. So it's it's an amazing experience.
Yes.
And yes, I did write about it. I self-published a book about my experiences in Peace Corps Korea a couple of years ago. But I think what it told me, and this was a long time coming. This is a realization that didn't happen for a while, but because of the Korean culture, which is extremely home-oriented and family-oriented, I got that issue in my head. It took a while to work out, and that's what I love about Maine, that you can feel like you're at home here. So that whole issue of being at home was a big part of my writing life, and I think being in Peace Corps brought that home. Very, very strongly.
Mm-hmm. It gave you an appreciation for home, hearth, and family, it sounds like.
Yeah, for sure. And seeing how the Asians are so oriented to family made me realize that maybe in America and the Western companies, we aren't so good on that. We could do better.
Mm-hmm.
We could pay more attention to how we grew up and where we came from.
Sure. Now, before you began publishing essays, I think you told me that you had done some work in the publishing area, a lot of it editing, acquisition, sales, and
mm-hmm.
it sounds like your focus might have been not so much on the creative side, the appreciation of the beauty, but more on production of things and preparation for mass audiences.
Yeah, and the money side too, and the people management side. That's where I eventually ended up, is mm-hmm. to worry about the business development and the growth and reputation and PR and marketing and selling and all that stuff.
I've heard a number of folks who have been down that road say they love writing, they would love to be a writer, but their experience on the business side kind of worked that out of them. I'm wondering how you avoided that.
I avoided it by staying in technical fields, science and medicine. So I think that would be true if I worked in sort of fields of fiction and novels and nonfiction and poetry. I think I would be a little disillusioned by what's happening in the publishing world right now and so-called trade publishing. But I stuck to the science side of things, and where things are a little more cut and dry, and it wasn't so, you didn't invest your soul in this kind of thing like you would in fiction.
Sure, sure. Now, I noticed with One Man's Maine that you had a publisher for that. It was Green Writers Press in Brattleboro, Vermont. And I'm wondering what you can tell us about how you connected with those folks. What was a literary agent involved, for example, and what lessons you might have learned from working with Green Writers and getting them to give you a thumbs up on One Man's Maine.
Well, I've never had an agent. It's really hard to get an agent, just as it's really hard to get published these days. So I just did the shoe leather and sent out proposals to a whole lot of publishers, and was fortunate enough to get Green Writers Press to like it. And we worked through some issues. They did a wonderful job designing the book. My daughters, they accepted my daughter's illustrations for the book and made it an integral part of the book, in my opinion. So they did a really nice job of publishing it, and I'm very, very pleased with that.
Wonderful. Was that process challenging? Was it frustrating to go from one publisher to the next? Or
yes, completely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything fun or exciting about that process?
Well, when you get that first expression of interest, that's fabulous. I mean, that's a real testament to your own persistence and hard work. So that was a satisfying, but it's really difficult, as you probably know, to get a book published these days. It's really hard, and with the way the industry is consolidating, and tough row.
Yeah, sure. What led you to choose the small presses to look at? It sounds like you made a conscious decision to try that route instead of going for one of the big New York City publishers.
Well, almost all the big ones will not read anything unsolicited. They require an agent be involved. And I always kind of wanted to do my own thing. Didn't really want an agent. So that limits you tremendously. Big publishers just won't look at you if you don't have an agent.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to try the smaller presses, and that can be very rewarding.
Sure. Speaking generally about small presses, can you describe advantages, disadvantages that you've observed about working in that world?
Yeah, obviously there's a nice attention to the production side. People really care about books. But most small presses don't have the time, money, or investment to make any kind of serious marketing efforts or distribution. So you're kind of on your own once the book is printed.
Mm-hmm.
A press will obviously list it in the major catalogs and with the distributors, but they don't have the money to finance author tours or bookstore buys or social media buys and advertising. They don't do it, so they can't. So it's kind of the author must do that. That's frustrating, I find.
Yeah.
That's not my temperament, you know. I don't particularly like to sell myself. So.
Sure. Have you undertaken your own marketing efforts? Has that been a big part of your work?
When each book was published, I did as much as I could on social media, of course, but also did a number of bookstore and library readings around the state.
And how did you get the bookstore and library readings arranged? Did you make your own phone calls, or did you have help with that process?
No, I did it all.
Okay. Well, that's admirable. That's that takes a certain amount of fortitude to call up somebody and say, "I wrote a book. Would you please let me come read to your to your customers?"
Yes, exactly.
Well, Jim Crochelle, I want to thank you again for taking the time to speak with us. One Man's Maine is the most recent book that I enjoyed tremendously. Owl's Head Revisited is the earlier one that sounds like it's just as fascinating. I have it on my list of books to pick up soon and go through. Thank you so much for your time and your insight, and I look forward to hearing more about your poetry.
Well, thank you, Spencer. This is really fun. Thanks a lot.